You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Part of the goal of this session is to develop an articulation of ideal privacy standards for an open digital library, actually without respect to the settlement or Google or anybody else in the first instance, so that we can talk about what ideal standards would look like, and then to come back to the settlement process. So that's why I said we might avoid the use of the G word and really think of good privacy for open digital libraries as being the goal. The second thing that I suggested is that we think about where to start. Now, the settlement is actually largely silent on this issue. There was some discussion of security standards, mostly with respect to protecting the information, but privacy, as it's generally understood, isn't so much about the security of systems, it's about the collection and use of the personally identifiable data. And on that particular category, the settlement really doesn't say very much. It's also true that G's privacy policies generally aren't all that effective. So to the extent that Google has said they would do something for book search, as they've done for some of their other web-based applications, I think we might say that's maybe not the best place to start. So what I'm interested in thinking about and using this session for, with as much input as we can get, is how to think about privacy in the digital library context by looking in lots and lots of other places. Librarians, for example, have been famously protective of their patron borrower records. If you go to the pre-automated age, librarians, particularly in the United States, oftentimes took the view, well, we really don't want to know who you are or, you know, why you might be looking for something, and to the extent that we collect information from you, it's really only for the purpose of making sure that we get that book back from you that we've loaned to you. But once we have the book back from you, we're no longer interested in keeping the information about you. So libraries actually established and routinely record destruction policies, because a librarian didn't want to be in the position of saying to a parent why a child might have borrowed a book, or saying to the, you know, police why a library patron might have borrowed a book. And it's a very interesting history. And I guess one of the other points I make is it's not just ancient history. It was actually one of the key battles in the Patriot Act just in the last few years, when librarians in Connecticut were asked to turn over library borrower records, and under the original version of the Patriot Act weren't even allowed to contact counsel to determine whether or not that was an lawful order that they had to comply with.
Can I interject?
Yeah, here.
Having said that, it is not true that libraries have carried over that tradition into their digital offerings. Although there are technical things they could do to extend an umbrella of privacy for their users, they have not prevented their electronic resource vendors from setting cookies, tracking users at all, as far as I know.
Right. And I think that's certainly true in many different ways, but at least as a starting point, I guess what I'm proposing is that if we had the opportunity to imagine the ideal world, you know, what type of information would we look at? Now, you know, Professor Lewis is here. Of course, one of the ways that the computing world has responded to the automation of information, to the extent that people are interested in privacy, is to try to think about ways in which technology might make it possible to recapture some privacy by protecting identity, by concealing transactions, and doing so in ways that I think are sometimes kind of counterintuitive. I mean, the idea that you can have an authenticated transaction between two parties without either party knowing the actual identity of the other party and still being assured that it's a legitimate transaction, it's not obvious to most people. It's actually a very difficult concept to understand. But I think it is something that we might want to think about as well, that whole category of ways of using the digital environment to recapture privacy. I'm personally fascinated by privacy law, mostly because I've spent a long time teaching it, but particularly with respect to state library patron law. Turns out that many of the strongest privacy laws in the United States have actually been passed by the states to protect the privacy of library patrons. And there are all sorts of legal standards in there. You know, do the police need a warrant? Do they need a subpoena? Can the library, when it has personal information, turn around and sell it? If a library has information about someone, does someone have the right to know what that information is? I think that's fascinating stuff for this discussion, something we might want to think about. And then, of course, you have sort of big overarching constitutional principles. The Supreme Court has made quite clear that you have the right to speak anonymously. One of the reasons you have the right to speak anonymously in the United States is because the country came about in part because people were able to write the Federalist Papers under pseudonyms to protect their identity because they had controversial views that were not as popular. Anonymity actually became a way to enable speech so that people could express things that were important without fear of repercussion. Now, the corollary right is less well established, but it's certainly worth talking about, the right to receive information anonymously. In other words, if we accept the premise that there's some value in people being able to express ideas without requiring to say who they are, should we also consider that there might be some value in people being able to receive information without being required to say who they are? And there's some history of that as well in recent cases. Well, in fact, my organization, EPIC, was the organization that actually raised this particular claim in a related case that went to the Supreme Court on the Children's Online Protection Act, which had to do with access to materials online. So I'm proposing this really as a starting point for discussion, and as much as possible, try to get people and maybe say a few words about your background and expertise. I'm kind of hoping we have a lawyer person, a library person, a technology person. We'll get those bases covered and see what we come up with. Does that sound okay? Good place to start. Would you like to start?
Sure, I'm definitely not the lawyer person.
That's
right,
fine.
Harry?
Right.
And I'm not, so I guess I'm the technology
person.
Which is
a good
thing. But I'm looking around the room, I'm seeing a few other technology people, so I don't know. I'm Sarah Cortez, and I'm an IT consultant, and I build large applications for Fortune 500 companies mainly, and I'm also a consultant on privacy and security. So I sit on a number of advisory panels to the Massachusetts Legislature on Mass Data Privacy Laws, and I...
Very significant law, by the way, in the privacy field.
Definitely, and undergoing major changes as we speak constantly. And I'm also a journalist, and I write for Tech Target Media on a variety of technical subjects.
Mm-hmm. I'm Eric Hellman, and for the past 10 years, I've been working on technology to help libraries manage electronic resources.
I'm Rod Sharp. I'm the library. I work for the BBC, and I came into your office about a dozen years ago.
Nice to see you again, too.
I'm Harry Lewis. I'm a computer science professor at Harvard. And for a while I was dean of college, so I had responsibility for all student records for a while and learned something about privacy stuff on the job in that context.
I think I worked for you about 30 years ago.
Where you worked for me, Sarah?
Yep, I worked for you.
Sarah worked for me. It's like a home week here.
Yep.
My name is
Probably too late to ask for a raise.
I'm an intern this summer at the Berkman Center, working on Project DRM for DocSurls. I volunteered to be the note taker today, and I'm very interested in what you just talked about, the right to receive things anonymously. Because on the internet, I mean, that's a big thing. I'm very interested in anonymous file sharing and the legality of it, and things like if you have a cache on your hard drive, it's usually to be part of an anonymous file sharing network. You have to have a cache of information on your hard drive that you don't know what it is. And so kind of like how that sort of, the developing law on that.
Okay.
Not an expert by any means. I'm more
no, that's question. Great. And Phil, are you joining us?
I'm going to join. I may float in and out. Okay, that's great. Well, because this is all really interesting stuff.
Well, let me tell you how my dream goes. My dream goes something like this, that, you know, Judge Chen, in the midst of this proceedings, got a big stack of papers and briefs on his desk, and he's trying to decide what to do. And there's a long pause in this courtroom that's filled with lawyers and cameras and advocates and everybody else, and he says, you know, the more I think about this, I have the sense that privacy is an enormously important issue that hasn't been adequately addressed by the parties in the settlement. And I would just really appreciate, he continues, if someone could give me like a brief outline of how we might address the privacy issues here, you know, based on law and standards and what technology makes possible. So imagining that dreams come true, you know, how would we kind of fill that space? What are the ideas that need to be put out there that haven't yet been discussed for privacy in our open digital library?
So let me just to start this off. You know, I think that there are technologies that are already deployed in libraries today that have the potential to extend privacy shields around library patrons. And with regard to the settlement agreement, if there was something to say that the rights of libraries to protect the privacy of their patrons should not be worked against by providers such as Google.
What was the subject of the sentence, the first part of the sentence? That there are
efforts to protect patron privacy should be allowed to go ahead.
No, you're asserting that.
No, so.
I just couldn't get whether that was, I just missed the first part of the sentence. He's saying that's a well-established fact that's, you know,
so
that
every, it, or. No. So what I guess the premise is that it's possible to, through technological
means, technologically possible
for libraries to extend privacy protection to patrons.
Right.
But it's also possible on the provider side to not allow those things to occur, either through contract law or through technological countermeasures.
Right.
So putting aside the obstacles for the moment, coming back to the first part, I can push you a little bit. What are the privacy interests that users of a digital library might have? And specifically, what techniques do you have in mind that help protect those interests?
To be able to receive information anonymously and to speak anonymously. I hate that. You know what I mean. Those things are important for patrons to do, especially in the context of libraries in the United States. And the technologies that exist today and are deployed are proxy servers, rewriting proxy servers. Most libraries already, especially academic libraries, most libraries already deploy them to extend access, off-campus access to electronic resources. Those same systems can be used to, for example, prevent cookies that aren't session cookies from being set on users' browsers. That's an example of something that can be done. It's not the only thing that can be done. But I don't know if very many libraries are taking advantage of that possibility.
Can I just ask, because I just like to reconcile what I was...
Sure.
You know, I'd like to reconcile the first statement you made, mm-hmm. that with the librarian's historical and even recent, vigilant defense of the, if not anonymity, at least the short retention time of mm-hmm. the general privacy interests of their patrons. Because then you said, but as libraries have gone digital, digital record keeping for physical collections, you're saying that the most of the systems deployed, just aren't honoring those.
Well, a typical electronic resource will keep its logs, right. Which has IP addresses. It will set cookies. It may track.
Is this because the librarians don't realize the inconsistency with these principles that they have held so dear in the past, or what?
I think it's viewed as being out of their control. And it might come up in a licensing, right. When a library goes to license something,
right.
There might be language that they fight for to make sure that fight for no identifying information to be kept by the provider. But typically, I doubt that actually.
Why would they keep an IP log at all?
Just by default. I think we're talking about a lot of things by default. Right. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think for a great number of librarians that aren't significantly technically trained in these issues, that they're just like people in other professions. There's a lack of awareness of some of the implications of some of the data and things that are being collected. So, for example, in answer to your question about what might one say to the judge with respect to the privacy issues, I think, one would say the collection of PII, the collection of non-PII, but that's, as the algorithms for identifying people, have proven that there's less and less information that's necessary to identify and pinpoint people, all sorts of information. So the most obvious is personally identifiable information, and then information with respect to what people are researching, I think, would be the two most obvious issues.
Let me throw out this question sort of as an anchor point, maybe, for our discussion. Let's say I'm a library, and I have a digital version of Shakespeare's King Lear, okay, whatever sort of solid public domain, right? And that's sitting on my server. And let's say I have a digital version of the Federal Register, right, that's a publication produced by the government, contemporaneous, by the way, on a daily basis, but it's also in the public domain. It's not some 19th century thing. And let's say I have a digital version of John Grisham's most recent blockbuster novel. Do you think it's fair to argue that at least in the first example and in the second example, as a pure librarian, which is going to be my starting point, I have no need or reason to keep any information about people who might want to download public domain digital works, including both the old stuff and the government stuff, putting aside my Grisham novel? Do I need to keep any data about those transactions?
I think there's, the question, need is a different question.
Might be useful.
Right. Collected. It's useful for libraries to do that. That's not to say that they need to do it.
So maybe I'm interested in usage activity. Maybe I need to know, is the interest in Shakespeare growing? Do we need to improve our collection, for example? I might keep aggregate data, right? If there was some way for me to keep a tally, for example, on how many times someone decided to download Lear, or someone decided to download some government publication.
That was great, because to keep the number of page views of a particular speech.
But would I, right, but would I need to keep, oh, speeches too. I mean, the president might give a speech, for example, public domain, somehow video format. I mean, you design these systems. So I guess my question is, at least in the most simplified scenario, why is any data being kept?
That's an excellent question. I mean, from a technologist's point of view, the answer always comes back to what the business requirements are. But from the point of view of a person who's concerned about privacy, I can't imagine any reason why that information would be required. But to take a devil's advocate position for a minute,
yeah.
If I'm in law enforcement and I am searching for a murderer who is a mass murderer, who's a multiple murderer, and he has delivered to the police some Google Maps printouts of the location of his victims.
Right.
And it's possible to trace back through and find that this place is so obscure that it's possible that by pinpointing the IP address and the personally identifiable information of the person that did this, I could solve this crime and stop this person. Now, is there a reasonable reason for me to collect that information? So that's sort of the other.
You have no idea how relevant that example is to this particular issue. Can I share a story?
Yeah. Please do.
So 20 years ago, I was a lawyer working for the Senate Judiciary Committee, helping to write privacy laws. And one of the laws we were working on concerned library records and video rental records. Because Judge Bork, who had been nominated for the Supreme Court, had his video rental records disclosed. And people said, oh, we need a privacy law. And so we were talking about what this privacy law should and should not cover. And I had a meeting with the FBI Hill director, who came in and said, imagine a scenario where we find a crime scene, perhaps it's a dead body, and there's a receipt for a video rental tape next to the dead body. Don't we have the right to go back and get information to investigate the crime? Wouldn't it be a good thing if, I mean, it's exactly, you know, turn the clock back 20 years ago, but it's exactly the same question. But here's the interesting answer. What if the business were to say, we simply have no reason for keeping that data? I mean, the telephone industry, for example, today is being urged to keep ISPs as well, to keep a lot of data on its customers they wouldn't otherwise need for commercial purposes. But people have said, well, if you keep enough data, it might actually be useful to help solve some crime. So I guess the question that I want to push you a little bit on is, if we agree that at least from the use perspective, it might not be necessary to keep the data on accessing the pure public domain works, should we keep it nonetheless, because under some scenarios it might be useful, you know, for solving crime, identifying a public health problem, right? Google flu trends, right?
Exactly.
Google wants, you know, they say, well, we want to keep search histories because it could actually be a good indicator, better than the CDC's indicator, of a flu outbreak, right? How do you feel? Is that compelling?
Well,
is that
the problem with it, and you know, and I, you know, when I think about that one, you know, so, well, you know, would you feel differently about it if the symptoms that people were querying turned out to be the symptoms for like the bubonic plague?
Right.
Right? Like, you know, then you might actually be really glad that they knew exactly, you know,
exactly.
Where they were coming from, you know, ex post facto. I mean, the problem, and I don't need to tell you, you know, it's always true that if you save more information, you
can solve more crimes.
Always true, they do, you know. So this, the only, and unfortunately there's now, you know, essentially zero monetary cost to saving data. So, you know, insofar as there's a trade-off, it can't anymore be because, you know, you ascribe some monetary value to, you know, solving that, you know, getting that serial murderer, and you have to balance it against the cost of saving all of this ridiculous amounts of information, because the cost of saving all that ridiculous amount of information is zero. So, and, you know, whatever the probability is that there might someday be a serial murderer and try to, you know, catch is always going to happen. So the only possible counterbalancing, you know, force against which to, you know, to trade off the potential benefits of these unforeseen crime solving or other perhaps societally useful benefits is that there's a societal cost to saving the data, because the data is going to be misused, because it's an invasion of some human right to privacy or whatever, and this starts getting into very much undefined territory, and you don't know what units to use to determine whether the aggregate cost of the society of saving all this information actually outweighed by the potential value. So there are, and one of the problems is there's two problems. The story I have in my own, there was a murder actually solved by the fact that there had been a unique Google map search, right? This was an MSN Live map search for the area where the murder had taken place or where the body had been dumped or something like that.
More than one murderer has Googled, has pinpointed the location of the dead bodies they've left using various map searches.
Okay, so then, but I have no idea how an economically rational summation of the societal benefits of all of those anecdotal, all of those things about which we have these remarkable anecdotes, how you add them up and how you compare them against the cost. The other side of it, of course, is your last bullet, because people come in and say, well, if the societal benefit is that the Capitol building doesn't get bombed,
right?
Okay, or whatever it is, the city of New York does not get nuked. That plainly is going to be a benefit that is going to outweigh any possible summation of all.
You kind of imagine these discussions where there's the proverbial balance.
Yeah.
People start off by putting little pebbles on both sides, and then pretty soon they've got cinder blocks and scenarios just keep getting worse and worse. But I guess what I wanted to do, and maybe taking us back a little bit to some of our design considerations for this digital library, is at least to suggest that there might be categories of information where arguably there's no need to collect data, or at least we might say to folks, well, can you establish the reason, the need to collect user
data? No library.
Right. I mean, there may be a security need. Are we the target of a denial of service attack, for example? I mean, that's oftentimes the argument for keeping log file data, for example.
Yeah.
But here's a security act, which is kind of, I'm not so sure about that.
I mean, as a business person, I'm fundamentally, I have many different, masks and views. I'm fundamentally a business person, and one thing I would just say about this discussion that we're having is to remind people that cell phone records were originally kept for billing purposes, and that's why the various companies were reimbursing each other for use on each other's networks. And on a practical basis, there's data that's collected even by libraries in the natural course of their business that's always going to actually be required, and in the incidental collection of that information that's created and preserved, there's going to be a secondary unforeseen use of it to solve crime or, stop something that's wrong. So I think the answer from a business perspective and a requirements perspective is there actually are legitimate interests that libraries have for collecting information relating to the conduct of the library, billing, usage, intrusion detection, and things like that, I think it's going to be extremely difficult to not find a nub of information that they're going to need to collect and that therefore going to be incidentally available. Does that make sense?
Okay. So, and something else you mentioned before, and maybe people are familiar with these terms, but PII and non-PII, right? So PII means personally identifiable information, and non-PII is not. That's oftentimes in the privacy world been seen as the tripwire for a privacy interest. There may be other concerns with non-PII data, but presumably they're not privacy related because you can't identify an individual. Now, I think what we've seen over the last few years, that line turns out to be a lot more blurry than people had thought because of, you know, the prospects of re-identification, because of what happens with massive data sets. I mean, you know, just to pick an example, you know, Google may not need to know an actual user ID in its logs to infer from a lot of related data with the same IP address, for example, and the similar search queries, who in fact that IP address is linked to, even if it's dynamically assigned. So I think those are good starting points to understand where the privacy issues might arise, but then I don't quite know.
What's the legal position here with a kind of umbrella data protection? I mean, is there such a thing?
Well, that's a good question coming from the BBC, because of course one of the things that distinguishes the US approach to privacy from the EU approach is that we don't have an omnibus-style privacy law. I mean, there is within the European Union countries kind of a presumption of legal protection. Now, you can talk about how that works in practice, but that is the starting point. In the US, most of the legislation is essentially sectoral. I mean, we have, you know, privacy legislation for medical records, but, you know, not generally speaking for internet records, and so there's kind of spotty coverage. But that also, I think, is what makes this particular exercise so interesting, because this has an enormous impact, right, on the users of digital works. I mean, this is really the go-to place if you're interested in getting access to information. And I kind of suspect, as I was at a meeting earlier this week with Dave Drummond, who's the vice president at Google, and he was asked the question, well, do you anticipate, you know, digitizing the books in the Library of Congress, right? It was kind of a very interesting corpus of material. He said, well, yes, eventually we hope to do that. So as big as this may seem, I think it's actually going to get bigger, right? So we're going to come up with some answers. I wanted to have a bit of a discussion about some of the technical solutions, or let's say technical approaches to try to, you know, enable transactions, and I think that's the right way to think about it. I think we're trying to enable transactions as opposed to creating barriers, while at the same time trying to safeguard the identity of users, right? So are there some folks who might talk about what those techniques might look like?
The first thing I would think of is encryption, some sort of standard encryption policy. And I feel like if you're saying, you know, we were talking about the potential social benefit if you catch a mass murderer or catch a nuclear plot, I can see that being resolved by saying, okay, fine, we'll collect the information, encrypt it in a way where perhaps the, I don't know if you want to like create a government agency or something, but there's got to be a way to encrypt the data where the library themselves doesn't have the ability to decrypt the data without another key. It's like a two-key encryption system, and that way you can store the data
right, and
keep it without having, I mean, because that's the issue we're discussing, right? Is the
now, when you say the data, what is it that you're, you don't mean the books, right? I mean, presumably.
No, like whatever the IP address is and other information collected about the user. And I've noticed that copyright, for me, in my personal experience, is what I've had a lot of problems with, because I'm a heavy utilizer of my database privileges at the University of Florida, the online databases. And it's different according to every single person. They, you know, some sites, you just come in under a blanket license. Other sites, you are only allowed access for your blanket license, and then you have to make an individual user account. Now, at that point, the encryption would fail, because, of course, once you're outside of the library at that point, you're no longer under their protection. And so, I don't know if encryption is really an easy answer, but I feel like it might be a step.
See, encryption is also an interesting technique, because it kind of presumes a certain arrangement of interests, right? I mean, in the pure public key world, for example, we have two parties that want to communicate secretly and securely, and they basically want to create a communications channel that can't be compromised by anyone else. So it's kind of like two parties against the world sort of thing. In other scenarios, we might imagine, you know, encrypting data that you possess or that I possess so that you know, no one gets access to that data unless you or I have decided that, we want to make that possible. But I'm wondering if you could say, sort of in this library world, who are the parties that we're trying to protect the data from? You see what I'm getting to here? Why are we deploying this technique? Not that we would.
In a typical situation, coming in as from the University of Florida or from Harvard, a user will want to, an electronic service will want to somehow verify that user is legitimately a member of that community to whom they have licensed that electronic resource. And so some sort of exchange of information has to take place so that the provider knows that they can legitimately give that person access to the resource. Now, that can be as sophisticated as something like Shibboleth, which uses encryption technologies to prevent the provider from actually knowing who the person is. Or it can be as simple as the provider saying, okay, give us your library card number, and then the library card number, if it has the right prefix, they say, oh, yeah, that's for that library, okay, you're in. On the one side, you have things that are definitely personally identifiable, PII data. And on the other side, it's extreme. On one side, it is PII, and the other way, it is not PII. But both are common. In fact, the low-tech methods are much more common than the high-tech, high-privacy methods.
But what's the threat model? All the examples I were thinking of were, you know, protecting the data from the government. Who else is? Is there any other actual threat except the government getting the data?
But when you have services that have advertising, the advertisers want to have as much information about the consumers as possible, so they can target ads. Google is in that business.
So let's take our Shakespeare example again. I mean, I was arguing a moment ago that in theory we could make that digital work freely available without any logging of access by a particular user. I mean, that's sort of pure intellectual freedom right there. But you might say, there's a wonderful Shakespeare troupe that's performing this summer. And if this person is downloading Shakespeare, maybe they'd be interested in getting this information. And if I happen to know that download is taking place, you know, from Springfield, Mass., then I'm sending them the contextual information related to their search, knowing a little bit about their identity. I mean, I ask that question in part, because of course it is also part of the structured settlement, but how do we reconcile that second use of the data with the traditional library functions? Is that a good thing, a bad thing, to be
that
encouraged,
of,
to be discouraged?
Of sort of, you're saying reaching out to people that might have an interest in the same subject matter?
Well, this is sort of our first effort to kind of pierce that shield of anonymity and say, well, if I know a little bit about you, and I don't even need to know yet exactly who you are, but I might actually be able to provide something relevant for you that you'll probably be interested in.
Well, do you then put that back in the user's control and give them a page of options before they sign up?
That's a good answer, I think.
Well, current laws require you to opt in to proactively say that you want to receive information from some. So you're not actually allowed to say, gee, I think I have some useful information. I'm just going to send it to this person because they might really appreciate it.
Which laws?
Right now in Massachusetts, you're not allowed to. That's a violation of privacy laws. You're not allowed to.
What is?
Taking information and proactively sending it to people. So, for example, if you're a nonprofit organization and you want to send your newsletter to people that visit your website, you have to ask them, do you want to receive this? And then if they say yes, you can send it to them. if they don't proactively say yes, that they want to receive that information, it's considered spam, and it will be eliminated, and it's considered a violation to do that. So that's the, sort of the good Samaritan, goodwill, contacting people is not actually allowed. It's considered an invasion of privacy right now.
But then if you're setting up the service, and you just get a page that says, if we'd like to keep a location, for example, would you let us do that? Here's how it would benefit you.
Right, then you can proactively ask the person, and they can say yes. If they say yes, you're good to go.
Cool. Yeah.
Otherwise, just collecting it.
I'm trying to figure out what's prohibited here.
It's automatically opting out, right? Unless there's...
It's an automatic opt-out. Exactly. Yeah. So, like, Constant Contact and all the major providers of emailing services for organizations, they have threshold filters, and they have policies and requirements that are in line with these that say that, we will not... You have to be able to establish and show us your database where people opted in order to send this information.
But you guys living in Massachusetts must not get any spam.
geographically specific advertising is not banned, right?
Advertising is different from proactively emailing somebody who is not, who is not specifically opted in to receive information. So what happens is that people will sign up for a newsletter or something, and they're not really interested in receiving ongoing information.
So I'm just saying, so in Massachusetts, okay, I can load a web page and have an advertisement that says, use Jay's dry cleaner on Beacon Street, which is around the corner from me. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I couldn't have an announcement from the live, the example that Mark just gave.
That could be,
well, but the advertising is pushed at me. I mean, is advertising
is
distinctly different from kind of information providing that Mark's trying to?
Yes.
So but Mark could buy ad space to send me the information about the troop that way if you wanted to.
Well, what's happening is there's cookies that's collecting information about you that's informing a decision to push an ad to sites that you're looking at.
This is very much on my mind because when I was out in Kalispell, Montana, where I had my summer home last week, and I was getting ads for Kalispell, Montana woman who lost 47 pounds using a certain weight loss diet, and I came home and I loaded the same web page again, and there she was, the same picture. She was now a Boston mom who'd lost 47, the same woman, the same 47 pounds, but she was now a Boston mom. so this
when that really is customized.
But this feeling, that's what I'm saying. Advertising, I mean, this is obviously being used in such a clumsy way that it actually is ineffective, but I'm trying to see where the line is between that, which is presumably fine, and what you've been talking about.
Well, I think it's a different context too, because in your example, if you were receiving, first of all, if you're just logging onto a web page, that's different than someone actually sending you an email. I'm not explaining myself.
Well, I mean that's the way. This happens to be it wasn't even a login, it was just some newsletter that I was, that I was visiting.
Well, in the context of collecting your information through browsing the web versus information at a library, I think the contexts are two different almost. It's really, even though it's the same information being collected, do you know what I'm saying? The context.
No, Harry's saying it's bothering him, so that's that's one of the key issues. I think you're correct that there's distinctions. There are distinctions that are made between different categories of collecting and receiving information, but
Would you say it's kind of like a loophole?
You could browse a web in a library.
But the library's not making any money off of that.
Maybe they are, and maybe they aren't, but that's maybe irrelevant because. a lot of data privacy laws, remember there are many data privacy laws that govern all sorts of things. HIPAA, for example, a medical data privacy law, is widely applied to things far outside the medical field for a variety of reasons. So libraries are subject to a lot of data privacy laws, depending on where they are also. But there's a view, you know, like with TJ Maxx, that, you know, libraries have a responsibility to protect your privacy. It doesn't have to do with whether they're making money or not. It has to do with the fact that if they're going to be in the business of being a library, that they need to safeguard your information. That's one view.
So in light of the Massachusetts law about, you know, not proactively emailing someone versus the advertising, is it considered that there is an assumed opt-in by going to someone's website that they're allowed to send you that ad? Or are those ads...
It's viewed as a different matter. Emailing things versus creating ads. I mean, people may not feel it's that different, but there is a distinction that's made. I think the idea is that sending a person email is somehow more of an invasion of privacy, even though it may be by a degree, than the invasion of privacy of saying, you know, I kept track of your flight information and your, you know, and all sorts of other buying information, and now I'm going to invade your privacy by popping your hands up.
We may be getting way off the subject, but I just didn't know that Massachusetts law worked that way. I'm a little surprised that it can, actually.
I mean, right, it's spamming laws also that govern this.
Well, see, okay, but spam is spam. What Mark was talking about was not spam. It's just about, you know, telling somebody about Shakespeare.
Well, no, he's talking about proactively emailing somebody who has not opted in.
But it's not, I mean, so, you know, if it were telephone, I know there are any, there, you know, telemarketing is a regulated industry. I understand that. It seems to be to me getting close to my speech rights if I can't inform you of something without your, even though you didn't ask me about you. But maybe it's okay.
Can I move our discussion to my third example, which is the presumably in copyright, commercially available book, which is now accessible in an online form. And I guess what I'd like to explore in this category of information is how we might make commercial payment systems work that protect privacy. In other words, let's assume that there's some category of material in our online digital library that if people knew about, they'd be interested in purchasing, and the authors would be interested in selling. But we might still say the privacy is important because, for example, you can walk into a bookstore, a newsstand, and, you know, buy materials with cash or pay with a credit card, and there's no real record created, and as an example of carrying over a norm from the physical world, we might try to answer the question, well, how could we make that possible in the digital world, right? We'll make the publisher happy, publisher will get
paid. To protect that information.
We'll get the reader happy, make the reader happy, reader buys the book, but somehow we're going to enable a transaction where there may in fact be no PII created that's accessible. Now, is that possible? I mean, can we do that?
Yeah, so we're working on that.
Okay, tell us how to do it.
Okay, so there's one of the projects at the Berkman Center is called Project VRM, where VRM stands for Vendor Relationship Management. Most of us are familiar with the reverse of that, which is Customer Relationship Management, so we're inverting that. We're trying to equip customers with ways of interacting with vendors on the customer's terms rather than on the vendor's terms. So,
cool. So
part of that is something called Emancipate. Like emancipate, and we're still working this out. But basically, it's not the payment system; it's the choosing system. And one of the choices can be, in fact, should be, I wish to make an anonymous donation. But we're working on this first with public radio, for example, and it's going to show up on the public radio player on the iPhone. There's 1.7 million of those in the world already. So, in a future generation of that, there will be something you can click on saying, I really like that song, I really like that program, I want to throw some money at it. Or for that matter, you can be reading a book and saying, I feel like sending a buck to the author. But it can be done in such a way that there is no PII, It can be an anonymous donation. The payment systems, as I understand it, whether it's Visa or Google Checkout or one of the other ones, don't have, they can just transfer the cash. They don't necessarily have to say who it came from if that's a choice going into it. They haven't dug that far into it yet as to
what is the status of things like PayPal and Google Checkout?
The status is they work. I mean, they're basically just payment systems.
But does the...
I don't know if they require...
If I make a payment via PayPal to X, is it possible for me to... It to be set up in such a way that X doesn't get any of my information?
I'll put out on that.
If I had to give you anything on top of my head, I would say no. And that... It's not really possible. There's ways to obfuscate that, but I wouldn't say they don't like that and they don't want to do that.
For the Amazon.
So let me just push you
Amazon
on
what?
Tip box?
Right. So tip. There are several. Amazon's tip box. There's something called TipJoy that's done by some people up the street in Arlington, and I believe their system actually allows you to be anonymous or to be revealed. So I think that the you know, if it's coming through them, so they can, in fact, we could actually use their API. I'm already talking to them about it. So if it comes to them through TipJoy, they'll know it came through TipJoy, and it came, you know, you're an author, you know, I want to send some money to Harry for Blown to Bits, right? I like the book, I want to send him a buck just because I like it, and all he'll know is he got some money from TipJoy. If I don't want him to know that it was me. And it came through PayPal.
So let me begin by saying this. There was a very famous article by David Shaw. This was in Scientific American in 1992, called Achieving Electronic Privacy. And David's contention is that it would be possible to have provably robust anonymous transactions. And I guess the question, you know, I would ask is, when you describe this as anonymous system, is that provable in the sense that, you know, if the police show up with a warrant that says, you know, there's money laundering going on or funneling of money to a terrorist organization and your service is implicated, please provide for us information about these, you know, sequential $20 transactions, 1,000 of which occurred in a 5-minute period on this date. Are you able to answer the question who that person was?
Do you want to talk about personal data stores?
Well, I'm not sure
that's the answer to it.
Well, yes and no. I think that the question in this particular case, if we're taking this example of I make a donation to Harry, I wish to keep anonymous, right. and I'm laundering it in a way. I'm achieving anonymity through the use of TipJoy. Can the police go and subpoena TipJoy or otherwise obligate them to reveal where the money came from? And I think the answer is yes to that question. I think that's the way they're set up now. I'm pretty sure that's the case. And I think that's part of the legal experience that PayPal had early on when they had a purely pass-through system that found them in hot water because a lot of international money laundering went on, and so they had to submit to a legal regime. I don't know what that
was. So now it actually becomes very important, I think, to come back to Harry's earlier point and think a bit about the threat model. In other words, if we imagine ourselves with privacy as a safeguard, the question is a safeguard against what? Now, typically in the idealized library world, the library isn't particularly concerned about why you did anything, because it's not trying to exercise any control over you. But there may be other people out there who are interested in what you do, and they will come to the library to try to get that information. Now, the concern then becomes if we say, well, this is a form of anonymity, but it doesn't strengthen the library's ability, for example, to resist that warrant. It's not actually a safeguard in the threat model. Does that make sense? So I'm just trying to understand, just mostly to push the envelope a little bit as we think about this digital library. If we're going to give people, you know, real anonymity, it would seem to be, and I don't think, you know, Harry probably it might be nice to know who your anonymous contributor is, but it's not like you're going to go after the person.
Well, the interesting, if not the defining use case here would be that, and probably I would not, my motivation would not be in denying Harry the knowledge of who's donating, but rather his publisher, because I don't want to get spammed by it. By marketers. I mean, that's the primary motivation for people.
Okay.
And it's a fairly lightweight thing. I mean, keeping marketers out is a lot different than keeping the police out. They're much less motivated. Okay, there's some resistance there. They're going to go find some other route to spam people if that's what their motivation is.
So that actually, I mean, that's a very interesting point, because it actually opens the door to a whole new range of threats which we haven't even talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, if you ask me to give you my email address, and I trust you, I still have to worry about that email address getting out somewhere, being harvested, and now I've got spam I may not want to deal with.
Right.
And then there are also identity theft issues. I mean, I might trust you to have some personal details about me or payment information for my library subscription service, but if you lose control of that, I'm going to have a problem. So it's gotten very complicated very quickly.
I think ultimately, though, there's a lot of advantages. Were you talking about personal data stores?
No, I skipped the personal data
store. I think it's interesting where who collects the information, right? Because if the library or there's an intermediary managing the data versus managing it yourself, it changes the way you look at the situation. But I don't know if there's really a broad way to deploy that as a solution in the near future anyway. There's some guys working on it in the UK, though.
Any universities?
It's MyDex.
Yeah, they're nonprofits essentially. They're peculiarly UK creation of community support.
We have 5 minutes. Is that right? I'm just looking.
I think we have a couple extra. I was interested in what you were saying. Like, once the information is leaked, it's leaked, and I find that's something that's really hard to get over. Even when we're talking about encryption and stuff, once it's unencrypted, once it's out, I mean.
But this is what's so fascinating to me about the library world, because there's a big, huge category of information which, if it's leaked from the user and library perspective, that's fine. We call that information the books. I mean, we want that information to be widely accessible. And the restrictions on the access to the information cause us concern. But there's another category of information, the transactional data, the user-identified data, the personal information, which, in an ideal world, I'm trying to suggest, if we could, we wouldn't even collect, right? That's how valuable that information is. Now, these two categories essentially coexist in the same system, right? And in our idealized world, we're going to try to push out the first category, I imagine, as much as possible. But in the second category, we're going to be enormously concerned, you know, about how that data might be used. So what I've been trying a little bit in this discussion is to think about, through traditional library means or through new techniques or, you know, whatever it may be, how we kind of treat that second category of information. You know, the status of IP addresses, for example, I mean, that actually turns out to be a very hot topic right now in the privacy world. Is an IP address personally identifiable information? If it is, it has all sorts of implications. I mean, to begin with, it suddenly becomes subject to a lot of privacy laws. The people who are in the business of collecting IP addresses, oftentimes for very good reason, just assume don't want to be subject to it, because now they have some responsibilities that they didn't have before, right? If they have to worry about what happens to those server logs. So,
and some overhead of staffing that requires them to dig up and provide that
and
information.
And costs, you know, I mean, a lot of headaches. Now, we've kind of said, well, look, if you don't collect the IP address, the problem goes away, right? Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't.
It seems to me you've set up a distinction here between the deliberate and the involuntary. And a lot of what you were talking about, the default settings, is involuntary. In other words, not something that you really think about as a librarian. It's just there. It's in the background of your machinery. And it's collecting and harvesting all this information. If I set out nefariously to use information gathered from a library, I can pretty effectively cloak my identity, can't I? But it's when I involuntarily get into the library and then find something that's interesting that I might use subsequently illegally.
I thought it was interesting if you go out here, I think in the basement of Harkins Commons, all the public terminals, I think, now have signs that say all the user identified information is deleted. In fact, that is a pretty typical practice now in public libraries, that they'll routinely clear caches, delete cookies, and everything else in between sessions. That's interesting, right? Because that's an example in the digital world of privacy safeguards being carried forward. Someone goes to a public terminal, buys something from Amazon, leaves their credit card information right on the last screen. Very easy to retrieve that.
Right?
I'm sorry?
Before the libraries even had the computers to use on the internet, it was just used for processing stuff for prison, etc. And I was out there, I can't tell you how many dozens and dozens of libraries. Every course I go, I pull up and stop and talk to the director about what points to consider. And that was one of them that they kind of like, just oh, that's not a big problem. You know, that's extra, you know, work for us to set it up or whatever. And they had no clue. And that these were librarians, well, I mean, there's librarians, in every profession, there's different levels of expertise and savvy. But that's huge. And question, just a little bit tied that onto the UK thing, I'm assuming that because of the European Commission and their long-standing collection of cell phone data, but they have a structure that, I mean, it can be saved, and I think it's still saved past 10 years, but how it can be accessed might be one of the models where we could look at, you know, because we don't have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, Europe has been far ahead of us in this. There are two security and privacy forum seminar series going on, one at Harvard and one at MIT that people might be interested in as well, and could put forward possible speakers.
So do we have a good answer for Judge Chen when he asks his question? How does he solve the privacy problem?
I think if we had a clear set of threats, as you keep saying, it's finally gotten through my head. But you know, if you have a good list of threats, I think it'd be a lot easier to analyze, you know, a lot of the systems that libraries are using to see whether they were robust against that threat.
I'm thinking about now about the settlement itself, which we said we weren't going to talk about. We probably shouldn't start talking about now.
But it doesn't really say anything on privacy, does it? Or if you
to the contrary. It says that certain information has to be reported back.
Right.
So it has some very clear anti-privacy stipulations in the
And is that setup. That's mostly for copyright enforcement, isn't it? Isn't that why the
Well, I'm not clear to me. They've posited a solution rather than defining a problem and insisting that a solution be made available. I mean, I think
aren't there parts of the copyright code itself that require certain amounts of record keeping by libraries when they make certain types of copies? Or am I just imagining that?
The parts of the settlement that I'm referring to are there's some kind of requirement.
But libraries have statutory exemptions for certain types of copying that they are allowed to do. But if I recall correctly, that copying is subject to detailed reporting.
Well, I'm resisting.
What I'd like to stick to, because we're starting so late, that question was raised in the 4 hours at the Boston Public Library last week, or the week before, and the answer was very specific that, I think it was Dan, who's representing Google, was challenged on that, and the specific language and issue was at length debated, and they came up with a requirement for session report to the degree of session, and therefore you can, with one more step, go like Anne was saying, just with one more step, you can get personal identifiable records. So that it is not even.
We don't mean to interrupt, but we're actually running a little short on time, so if you want to start wrapping up.
I'm resisting the moral equivalency of photocopying to, you know, a guy goes in and wants to read a book on the terminal and has to give away his identity in order to do that, which I think to some degree is what the settlement